Welcome to The Teaching Curve, a podcast exploring the pedagogy of global politics and international studies, produced under the auspices of the Innovative Pedagogy Initiative of the International Studies Association and made available through the ISA Professional Resource Center. I'm Jamie Free, Associate Provost and Professor of Global Politics at Bridgewater College. Each month, The Teaching Curve brings you a conversation with engaged and innovative teachers of politics and global issues. The goal? To celebrate and inspire pedagogical creativity by exploring the range of ways in which teachers can create environments in which students form the new neural connections that we call learning. Teachers are people who bring the new into those environments, who create the opportunities and the incentives for students to turn on their own light bulbs. Hearing innovative ways in which others actualize their teachings can bring joy back into a process that, especially at the end of a semester, can too easily fall into that category of activity called work. Today's conversation is about something that many people characterize as the opposite of work, and that is games. It is with Dr. Mark Harvey of St. Mary University, Dr. James Pigeon Fielder of Colorado State University, and Dr. Ryan Gibb of Baker University, all in the United States. Mark, Pigeon, and Ryan are the editors of a 2022 volume from Routledge entitled Simulations in the Political Science Classroom, Games Without Frontiers. Our conversation explores how instructors should adapt games and simulations to different audiences in different classroom settings. Practical considerations about how to run games that increase student learning in demonstrable and accessible ways. And how the identities that teachers and students adopt as an integral part of games intersect with those identities that they normally bring into the classroom. Welcome to three of you. We have Mark Harvey, Ryan Gibb, and James Pigeon Fielder here to talk about a book that they put out and to talk about simulations and games within the International Studies classroom context. And so I just want to welcome you all three and thanks for stopping in over your Christmas holidays. I appreciate that.
Thank you. No problem. Happy to be here.
So one of the things we always start with on this is talking with each of the guests about the context within which they teach, because we think that helps both define them as teachers and for people to think about whether their contexts are similar and how they're using the advice that people give. So if you could each just start, and I'll let you guys determine the order for that, talking about the students at your institutions and as a way of defining those places.
All right, since we're staring at each other uncomfortably, I'll go ahead. So first, I want to make fun of both myself and Mark for wearing the same shirt, totally unplanned.
Wow.
So yeah, teaching at Colorado State University, very interesting. It has a very strong agricultural and veterinary and environmental focus, which then infuses the department. Our political science department at CSU has a strong environmental politics program. So a lot of my students then are from Colorado, smaller towns. If from a larger city, it would be Colorado Springs and the Denver and surrounding area. But again, a lot of students majoring in like soil sciences, plant sciences, and whatnot. So I teach a lot of non-majors in my 100 level course. So on to, I guess, Ryan.
Sure. No, I teach at a small liberal arts university in Kansas. We have about 900 students. My line is international affairs. So I teach political science as a minor at my school. But it's great because I always have a strong cohort of undergraduates, all undergraduates, in political science. So I get to teach games in lower college and in upper college courses. Generally in the lower college courses, like everyone else, I think you have people who are deeply invested and people who are lightly invested in the content material, but games kind of bring everyone together. Yeah, generally great students, really interested and invested in coursework, once they have some buy-in.
All right. I teach for the University of St. Mary, also a small liberal arts university in the greater Kansas City area. My position is somewhat unusual, and so are the students that I serve. I have a PhD in political science, and I sometimes teach political science courses, but I'm actually employed by the Division of Business and Information Technology. Based on some of the econ and business background that I had, I actually teach business courses, and I run the MBA program. And so my student population is a little bit all over the place, right? So I have undergrads on the one hand. We have really quite a diversity of different students, of different previous experiences. And it's sometimes challenging to meet that diversity of experience. At the same time, I'm also teaching classes and running games in a national MBA program that is well established and well regarded. And so I get some of the smartest people, you know, who really have a lot of professional experience and a lot of academic credentials on the other end too. So I'm a little bit all over the place.
Well, what I love about this diversity in the ways that you all, your experience and your context is, of course, when you're creating a book project to try and pull together ways to teach students international or political science things through games, you're going to be pulling in all different kinds of games, all different kinds of pedagogy approaches that would help make that happen. And so I'm assuming that that really comes through. I haven't read the book yet, but that comes through in the chapter selection and in the ways that you guys brought people together to address those kinds of issues.
Oh yeah, absolutely, definitely. One thing I know that kind of separates our book, or we were really deliberate in trying to separate our book, was this focus on assessment too. As a student and as a graduate student, I didn't know that this was so important, like showing evidence of learning. That's something that we wanted to focus on.
I would add to that we, the balance of the foundational literature was in the front matter, mostly where we have the theory of why games work, but each contributor was allowed to include literature on their own pedagogical approach, like why I designed it the way I did, why I wanted to cover the specific topic, and their unique individuality in designing their game.
Yeah, and I want to connect the pedagogy to your question about the kinds of students that we have as well. Is that one thing that I think really unites nearly everybody is that games are fun, games are cool. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a student that maybe isn't the top of your class, or maybe you are a super high achieving competitive student. You know, if you design a game well, then it's going to appeal to all of those people and hopefully will help you achieve those course objectives using this method that really is extremely engaging.
Well, I think that that's, in some ways, the skeptics who are sitting out there going, yeah, I don't know if I buy this game stuff. It just sounds like the fun side of things, would be really invested in hearing that that assessment piece of it that demonstrates that it's worth the effort for them to go through the work that it involves to be able to manage, to build a game, or to even to manage one that's already built. That's just different from how most people have been trained to teach. And so convince them that that is worth the investment of their time in terms of their student learning.
So for me, I kind of started this project because I met this guy at a conference one time who was using diplomacy in the classroom to try to teach international relations to his students. They were very engaged. He presented a paper on it. And I came up to him. I'm like, man, we should publish something on this. And he's like, it's not going to matter because at my department, these guys who are, you know, they're not going to give me tenure, because they're skeptical about the methods that I use. Mm. And so when we wrote this book, the beginning of it, certainly in the first several chapters, is a defense of exactly that. This idea that, like, you know, this isn't just the fun stuff. I mean, it's fun, don't get me wrong, but it is more than that.
So yeah, the power of games really rests in what I'd say two major concepts, the magic circle and symbolic correspondence. The magic circle, also called synthetic experience in virtual reality, presence, Victor Turner called it liminality, that you cross into this ritual space that becomes real to you, and everything that happens to you in that space feels real, even though it's risk-free. And then when you come out of the magic circle, assuming it's properly debriefed, then you remember everything you learned, and it sticks with you. And then people from that, from the magic circle, people can remember games they played 30, 40 years ago with crystal clear clarity. Yet they can't remember what they ate for lunch the day before. And then the symbolic correspondence that comes from animist religion, where you would the ritual performers would put on the cloak of an animal, the mask of a spirit, and perform the ritual in this massive liminal space, magic circle space, where they're both the performer and the actor. And they didn't just pretend they were the animal, they became the animal. Now, the modern skeptic would say, we don't do that anymore. And I would say, you wear a suit to work, you put on a uniform in the military, you go to your favorite concert wearing a rock t-shirt, or you wear the colors of the role-playing games, that's symbolic, of course, but you're putting on the skin of something and you're embodying it, and you remember what it feels like to embodying it. So if you're training somebody and they're in the classroom and you say, I want you to embody a president, I want you to embody the Secretary of Defense or a Prime Minister or something, while they're wearing it inside the magic circle, they become it and they remember that when they come out of it.
How do you make sure that what they remember is the learning objective that's related to politics or international politics?
I'm big on everything needs to be built from the objective. So if I'm going to design a military game, a classroom game, a business war game, whatever, I first want to understand, why am I building it? What is the objective? What am I trying to achieve, and how do I measure it? From that, I build backwards. Like I've seen too many games fail in the classroom, in the boardroom, and in the military because they didn't build an objective around it, and they didn't know what they were trying to measure. Therefore, they had a lot of fun for ultimately wasted effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll add that that's in part what this book is about, right? It's part of its purpose is to convince people that otherwise wouldn't do this, that this is a noble purpose. This is something that's really worth doing. But the other part of it is for those people who have never done this before, it shows you how to build game. It's got a chapter on that, right? And every one of these chapters are things that are not only assessed and have the theory behind it, but somebody could just sort of like treat it like a tear sheet and just say, all right, here's a class that I can use. It's got easy rules, play by play. This is what I need. And you can go do that. So it's got the pedagogy, it's got the theory, it's got the how to, and it has some games that they can use to get them started and running across the political science curriculum.
And I think that's really what I'd add or supplement with that is that it does marry those ideas, right? The ideas or concepts we want to come out of the chapter, the vocabulary from the chapter, the relationships from the chapter or the concept that you want in this lesson. But then it's something that people do currently, right? Like Pigeon was saying, you don the skin, you adapt a vocabulary when you play a game, you understand relationships when you play a game. And each of these chapters, if they're theory chapters from IR or something, like you're beginning to learn the relationships between the players. When the vocabulary changes and the relationships change, if you put that into a game, you can see that embodied and enacted right in front of you, and that helps you to remember it.
And so if you go through this simulation, right? And they're playing the role, just like one of these theorists would suggest that people in the real world play this role. They are doing exactly what Ryan suggests, right? They're bringing these things in so that they're living that identity. Mm-hmm. And they're integrating these theories. You know, you teach them a theory one day, they're going to forget it the next, but you have them have this experience and you say, oh, by the way, that's called realism, or that's called liberalism. I mean, it's like, they're like, oh yeah. And then you can talk about it in class. Like, you know, that time when, you know, John did this, well, that's an illustration of security dilemma. You know, that's, they've just lived it. I don't have to explain it to them.
So to me, what you're talking about, it seems critical to this success, which is the frame, right? And I would see, I would want to hear both about how you frame it before they go into the game, and about how you debrief after to be able to make those connections for them and so that they're being metacognitive as they're going through, right? But at the same time, then they're not sure exactly what they're going to learn, and so they need to unpack it at the end. Is that fair?
Yes. I'll start with the before. I'll let somebody else handle the after, okay? Because this is another sort of big discussion that we have in one of the themes of the book, is that do you set up the game by explaining it to them so it's an illustration of what you just learned, or do you just throw them in and then explain to them afterwards, like, oh, by the way, what you just did, this is what it is. And I think the answer is it depends on the game and it depends on the objectives. Like, when I do an international relations course, and I'll use RISC as an example. I use RISC as a game. I like playing the game first because I don't really want them to know the theories. I don't want them to understand or try to apply what they've learned. I just want them to sort of understand that, like, this is how people behave when you're playing in a game, right? And now if you take that thing and you expand it to the real world, then this is the way we might explain it in, you know, diplomacy or whatever, right? And to me, that's a logical order. But there are other games out there where it's like you kind of need to know a little bit. Like, let's say you're doing a simulated legislative thing or something, right? Probably understanding what the roles of those people, what their jobs are and how that works is going to help you have a better simulation in that case. Because you're not just playing a game, you know, you're doing a simulation of something that is more realistic. So I think it really kind of depends on the situation.
I'll give another example to what Mark said. My chapter is on model diplomacy. And so I get the students to know a little bit about the roles of the National Security Council. And it gives us a lot of opportunity to talk about, like, how you see a situation or problem or solution depends on where you, what powers you have to respond to that power and solution. So it is a lot of fun, but it does require a little bit of research. So of course, their first assessment is to figure out who is this person in real life and what powers do they have via their position in real life. And then after we play out a simulation that the Council of Foreign Relations provides for us, then we're like, well, like, what does this look like? What relationships were at play? Why did we come with the outcome we came to? How could we have come to a different outcome? And sometimes it's like the interpersonal dynamics, which you may or may not read about, but sometimes it is just right, how you would expect a game to play out or how historically it had played out a crisis or a situation. So there, the debriefing, I think, is probably for Pigeon.
So I'm going to, before I get to debriefing, I will address Mark's comment on it depends, in that using my 100 level courses, they'll have 150 students and it's non-majors. For that course, it's more like putting a frog in cold water and turning up the heat. That one I'm a little more careful about. Everyone knows what they're doing, what the objectives are. This is how the game works. And we kind of build up to it so they feel comfortable. Uncertainty is good to a point in a game. But for that large of a course with so many moving pieces, I want to give them a little bit of bone here and there. But for my 300 level course, which was almost entirely political scientists with a few history majors in it, that one I feel more comfortable throwing them into a scenario with a lot more uncertainty and letting them kind of climb out of it. And they actually enjoy it. But at that point, they know most of the vocabulary, as Ryan said. So they're more comfortable in working with the uncertainty. Now for debriefing, I'm big on written debriefs as a form of assessment. In fact, I'm 98% certain, but not 100%, that in my chapter Gaming to Lose, I talk about the importance of debriefs. I don't grade students in their actual performance in the game itself. If I do that, it has a chilling effect on their willingness to perform. But if I tell them that you can fail spectacularly or you can triumph over everybody, but it doesn't matter in your grade. But what I want you to do is capture that in a written debrief where I ask a number of questions that they have to answer. That's one, it both solidifies the material in their heads. It's what another theorist, McKay, called memorializing the event. They memorialize it in their head, but also then gives me something that I could quantify for a grade. But also at the same time, I don't make it a humongous portion of their grade. I don't want them to sink or swim based on a game, if you will, but enough to make it matter, if you will, that they actually participate.
And that's enormously important, that the classroom, I know this sounds kind of contradictory to the way some people run them, but like the classroom needs to be a safe place to fail, right? You know, they need to feel like I can take a risk and do something unusual that maybe I wouldn't ordinarily do and stretch my mind, and maybe it doesn't work out. And, you know, you're grading them based on what they learned from the experience as opposed to whether they win or lose the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is I think that's a really valuable point about thinking not just about the previous knowledge that students may have coming into it, but their commitment to actually executing the thing, right? I mean, there's ways in which you can assume something about people who have decided that they're majors or that they would be ready to invest. But in some of these, I mean, like role-playing sounds like fun to me, and I know it's fun for you all, but that may sound really dangerous and risky for people who you're asking to put on somebody else's skin for a variety of reasons, and not least that they're doing it in front of their peers. So how do you address that?
Yeah, I'll just say that any game involves role playing, right? You play Monopoly, you're a real estate baron capitalist, right? You don't call yourself that, but based on the rules of the game, that is the role that you are probably going to perform. You know, you don't necessarily have to give people titles and names and positions and all this sort of stuff in order to try to create that identity experience, that liminal space that the Pigeon is talking about, right? Now, you can up at a level and you can have people role play and they can do that. But, you know, again, I think that that commitment to some extent depends on the student themselves and how far they want to go down that road. But even if they do minimal identity engagement, I think it's still beneficial.
That's also where the debrief comes in that there's also another concept called bleed, where someone who's playing a character, let's say two people playing characters, they get an argument as characters and then actually carries over into them arguing with each other as people. The debrief helps mitigate that. Like I remind them, the lights come on, the stage, you know, stage opens up, that you're debriefing. Yeah, a little, some of it comes for yourself, but you think about what your character would have done and let bygones be bygones. You leave the bad and behind the magic circle and you take the what you learned coming out of it. Also, if I see something breaking out in class that I should deal with directly, I do an immediate verbal debrief on the spot with both students. And 99.999% of the time, that works. It makes them, one hand, it keeps them in the game. It like doesn't break the bubble, break the fourth wall, whatever. But at the same time, make sure that they remember they're not arguing as people. They're arguing as characters.
You're not going for the Stanford experiment here with this.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Well, yeah, to follow that up too, right? Like you have relationships that exist outside of classroom that come into some of these games. And as I think Mark and Pigeon are at least vaguely referring to, we have lots of introverts, people who don't want to stand in front of the class and be the showmaster. So there are ways, the book talks about different ways we've done this, maybe not explicitly, but I like to break my model diplomacy into little caucuses that groups can talk to each other, and I can stoke some flames within those caucuses or those groups talking to each other that have similar interests. So they can provide like a kind of a joint policy or a joint idea together. So it doesn't just have to be one person in front of a group. I know I wouldn't have liked that as an undergraduate. It's easier to be on a small team than to stand by yourself sometimes too. So I think it is game dependent. I think it's relationships dependent, but there are different ways to think about working through those relationship problems or situational kinds of problems.
One of the themes that I'm always looking for is ways to make students into agents, into people who experience their ability not just to act, but to change things about how stuff's going. And what I really like about these, about simulations in general, but also about the attitude that you're talking about and bringing to the game, is that that's a lesson that's so beyond what a particular learning objective is for the course, right? But that they come out with this idea of themselves as people who can make choices and make decisions and enact things that affect how the group and how the, you know, by analogy, then the society in general works.
Yeah. And I would advocate agency to the extreme, because obviously, you know, the game itself is a structure. It has rules, right? And the course objectives are a bit of a structure. If you don't achieve these course objectives, then you're kind of failing, right? You want this to happen. But at the same time, it's like if you're designing a good game, and there's an element of it being unpredictable. You don't know what the students are going to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the game or simulation is going to go in directions that you have never seen before. And I would say that's probably true every time I've done something. Someone's going to do something that I didn't expect that will move things in a new direction. I'll give you an example of a game that I did before with an international political economy class, right? So I have the students play this free trade game. And there's basically they're trading tickets and stuff like that. But there's one guy who ultimately, it is pretend money. This one guy just hoards everything. He buys everything in the room, right? And he's doing it just to sort of flaunt the fact to me. He's sort of giving me some attitude like, you know, ha, 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 I broke your game kind of thing, right? And then we start talking about like, okay, so what happens when a country like borrows way too much and just buys a whole bunch of stuff, right? And so it becomes a different kind of a lesson, a different kind of a debriefing where this person shot it off in a different direction. And suddenly we're learning lessons that are beyond just what the course objectives were in the first place.
Yeah, I would say adding on to that, in my assessment, the worst thing you can do in any game, professional entertainment, education, is to railroad the players. And then the viewers who don't know what railroading is, that's where you're basically forcing the players literally down a track to an end that they have to achieve. And no matter what they do, the end is always the same. And that basically, when they get to the end, there's no payoff. The players feel like they've been cheated. Like, then my agency didn't matter. So I always play it. I tell my students, I know how this game starts. You know how it ends. Now, let me take that back. There's nothing wrong in the teacher's mind if they have a rough, loose idea of where they think the game is going to end. Mm-hmm. But I'd say let the players go. And matter of fact, this last semester, I've been running classroom and military games for a very long time. For the first time I had a classroom game, everyone failed. That's never happened before. I was stunned and the students were stunned. They basically at the very end, in the middle of a zombie apocalypse, decided to have a launch a nuclear attack against each other. And I only had 5 minutes left. And I looked at all the students and I said, guys, gals, I don't have enough time left to actually adjudicate this. So that's the end. You all a bunch of bloodthirsty animals. And the whole the students cheered wildly, like, yes. Like, all right, realism one, liberalism zero. But that's the way it is. Yep.
Just listening to Pigeon and Mark reply, I was thinking that my students are generally pretty pacifists. Whenever it comes to a decision that could be violent or that could be aggressive, a lot of the times they step back. And it always prompts me to ask the question, why does this not exist in reality if it exists within these four walls, right? Like, why? What are we missing from the simulation that doesn't capture real behavior? Because I think that's educational in its own right. If we're simulating the Cuban Missile Crisis, or we're simulating the Russian invasion of Eastern Europe or something, like, why don't cooler heads prevail if they prevail in this room? And that opens up all kinds of conversations. Hopefully it doesn't just trigger everybody into saying, oh, they're barbarians, right? No, they're thinking the same way you are. There are other things we should think about. Interpersonal dynamics, interdepartmental dynamics. Like, it's more complicated. Let's talk about the complexity, because that's so much richer than just writing people off or consigning something to a definition, right? So when it comes to students that are surprising, generally the surprising is more compassion than we see in reality. And then we try to just like bridge, like, why don't others behave like we're behaving in here? What are we missing in the simulation, or what are they missing as they're having these high level talks?
Well, I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. So Mark, Ryan, Pigeon, thank you so much for coming and describing both the content of the book and getting us to think more about it. Thought for me about both the process of doing it and the assessment, the reasons, the ways in which my identity as a teacher get factored into that. All of that's so valuable. So thanks very much for coming to talk about that.
Well, you're welcome.
Happy to be
here. Thank you.
You can find episodes of The Teaching Curve in the Professional Resource Center of the International Studies Association. It's made available under the auspices of the Innovative Pedagogy Initiative. You can send feedback or suggestions for future interviews to teachingcurve@isonet.org and follow us on Twitter @teachingcurve. While you're on ISA's website, check out the schedule and register for the Innovative Pedagogy Conference, be held in Montreal on Tuesday, March 14th, the day before panels begin on the main ISA convention. It's a great place to have conversations about the pedagogy of international relations and global politics and to increase your network. Thanks all for joining us again on The Teaching Curve. And remember, learn something every time you teach.